Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, founder and CEO of the City's First Podcast. Super excited to have everyone here today. I believe it's our 23rd episode. Here today, we have Nico Larco with the University of Oregon and the Urbanism Next Center in, I believe you're in Eugene, Oregon. Is that correct, Nico?
Portland, Oregon, actually. I was in
Sorry,
Eugene for a
Portland,
while,
my
but
bad.
I actually teach out of Portland.
Okay. So you're a little further north. That's great. That's great. So thanks so much for joining. Now, we've kind of traded notes for quite a while and we're super excited to get your take on new mobility, kind of what's on the horizon and whatnot, and really just kind of pick your brain on what's happening between academia, practice, and just kind of the general industry at large, kind of in this post-COVID city that we're all working in right now. So with that, again, thank you, Nico, for joining us. And I'm just going to kind of go through your bio. I think all of our subscribers and listeners know the usual format or shtick, shall we say. So kind of go through the bio, read off a few questions. It'll be a nice little exchange back and forth, really conversational, organic, and then we'll just kind of close out with some final thoughts from you on what's on the horizon. So with that, I think I'm just gonna set the stage here and kind of let everyone know what it is we're talking about. So basically, Nico Larco is professor of architecture at University of Oregon, director of the Urbanism Next Center at University of Oregon, and co-founder and co-director of the Sustainable Cities Initiative, a national and internationally awarded multidisciplinary organization that focuses on sustainability issues as they relate to the built environment. Professor Larco's research focuses include sustainable urban design and the impacts of emerging technology on cities. The Urbanism Next Center, which he leads, is focused on how technological advances such as AVs, new mobility, e-commerce, and the shared economy are changing city form and development. Professor Larco has received numerous national and international awards for his work, has been a distinguished Fulbright Association scholar in Chile and in Spain, and was a visiting researcher at Delft University of Technology and TNO in the Netherlands. He's a licensed architect and has worked professionally in the fields of architecture, urban design, planning, and development. Larco is the principal of Larco Knudsen, an urban design consulting practice in Portland, which focuses on sustainable urban design and assisting with the resiliency of projects in the face of rapidly changing technology. So, impressive bio, lots to talk about. I actually had to pare it down a bit. I hope you don't mind, Nico, just for a
No
second.
worries. No
There was
worries.
about another paragraph there, but we just got to kind of catch this. So, but it goes on and on. It's really great stuff. So, with that, let's just kind of roll up our sleeves and get started. So, got about 25 minutes for questions here. First question I'm going to throw at you is how has the urban mobility landscape evolved over the past 5 years, vis-a-vis pre and post-COVID?
Okay. So mostly with the COVID topics you're interested in. COVID obviously put a huge wrench into the way everything was working. Not that everything was working great. But one of the biggest shifts that we saw was, I'd say two large shifts, was one, a big shift to work from home, and the other one is a big shift to e-commerce. I'll start with the e-commerce one because that one was more of a blip than anything. We saw, enormous increase in 2020 and beginning 2021 to e-commerce. It had been a growing trend for years, but it just, went up I think like 25% over that year. But then it came down again. So the e-commerce would have has huge implications in terms of how we get our goods, right? So delivery is a big part of the e-commerce part of the equation. The 16 Amazon trucks Prime trucks that come by, drive by my home each day, is part of that. So we saw this big blip, and then it came back down and kind of dropped for a little bit, and then it started to go up, and now we're at the level we were at in 2020 again. So it's a total of about 16% of all retail trips, or sorry, of all retail sold in the U.S. is happening via e-commerce. That obviously puts a big strain on the transportation system because of the amount of movement of goods, and the idea that a truck. When I go to the store, I buy tons of items, and yet a truck usually comes and delivers one thing at a time. So there's efficiencies, and especially if you think about the 1 and 2 hour delivery kind of issues, those things are really inefficient. So that's one kind of piece. The other really big piece really has to do with the work from home shift. And work from home went crazy after the pandemic. It came down and stabilized at around depending on what numbers you look at, somewhere between 25 to, I'd say, like 45% of people were working from home for some amount. It's kind of interesting. We've seen a trend most recently where it seems to be dropping even more. A lot of companies are starting to understand that work from home works for some things, but it's really not as productive, especially for younger employees. But that trend for, to the shift for, to work from home had a big change effect on the transportation landscape. On the one hand, we saw enormous drops in peak commute times. But interestingly, we didn't see drops in overall travel. So actually, you look right now, and I think we're at something like, I want to say like 15 to 20% higher total trips than we had before the pandemic. But our work from our peak trips, the morning commute and the evening commute, have actually flattened a whole lot. So generally, if I'm working from home, it turns out that people are also doing, their daily trips to the bank or, to pick up a grocery or to do one other errand. They're still making those trips. They're just not necessarily doing them at 9 o'clock or at, 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the corollary to that as well has been a huge drop in transit utilization, and that's been tremendously painful. Transit has been hit really hard, especially here in the United States, but I know in Europe as well, post-COVID. And that is, is something that I think everywhere is still grappling with and figuring out how exactly to deal with that.
Yeah, it's just in really interesting kind of these peaks and valleys we've seen, especially with the total VMT, which is overall increased, but we see the less peak off peak, the two peaks, the commuting standard kind of post, late 20th century, early 21st century model. Transit has, I would imagine, from what I've seen recently, we're at parity with 2019, at least here in Europe, for most PTOs and PTAs. It seems like in the US we're almost at a 100% recovery with many systems, or at least that's what they're promoting. At least that's what LA Metro is saying. That's what BART is saying, all that stuff, but yet to be seen. There's more work to be done, as you're rightfully mentioning. And then in terms of the trends of e-commerce, kind of back to the 2020s level, it is interesting because there's been so much startup activity in curb space management, digitizing the curb, and all these other, kind of monetizing and profit making schemes around, e-commerce and deliveries. And it's yet to be seen, which path we're going to go in terms of, kind of a solid commercial model, but also from regulatory challenges from cities. And then what are the ultimate consumer preferences, and what is the path forward in terms of, bricks and mortar versus, this 15-minute delivery type of, paradigm that was hyped, let's say, as peak 2021. I would say 2020 was just, it was insane.
And it's interesting, like this is like a side note, but I've noticed like an interesting trend in there was a huge push towards the digitalization, and you'd go places and it'd be the digital menus, and you could order online before you
QR
got there
code
and all
for
that.
it.
And
We
those
had those
things
here in
are
Europe.
Yeah, those things are, they're kind of waning. It turns
No,
out that
nobody
people actually
people
like to
wants.
see talk to
Yep.
people. There was
Yep.
just an article
People
this
want
morning
paper
on
menus.
people there was just an article this morning about the turnaround that Starbucks is trying to do right now. And a lot of it is that they're realizing that all of this, order remotely and just swing by and pick the thing up isn't the experience that people want, right? Which so I mean, this is the big shift of understanding is, are you buying that because it's a commodity, or are you buying that because it's a commodity with an experience?
Absolutely.
And it seems like we're starting to realize that experiences are pretty important to us.
Yeah, as human beings, and it's kind of really anathema to the 15-minute city concept that Carlos Moreno talks about, and everything in terms of everything being localized within a, a convenient distance and whatnot. But if we're focused on kind of this very sedentary lifestyle, Wally, as we mentioned, then you really the 50 that kind of throws the 15-minute city concept out the window. So really, what are our values as a society, and how are we going to embed them in our activities, routines, regulations, and everything that follows suit from that? So, yeah,
But
so
the
moving.
15-minute city actually allows us to do all sorts of experiences by foot or on bike pretty easily. So we still can have those experience, right? Not the 15-minute city doesn't necessarily have to be the 0-minute city, right? Where like everything's just digital and ordered in.
I think that's the conflict, is the 0 minute city for things. That's, I guess, what I was thinking was, just this instant convenience, instant gratification, as we Americans love. Yeah, in my opinion, this is not a fact, but in my opinion, is anathema to the 15 minute city, which
Sorry, I misunderstood. Yeah, absolutely.
being active and moving your muscles and, kind of moving about these kind of neighborhood nodes and corridors. So absolutely, yeah. Okay, so let's kind of move on to the next question here, a little bit more techno-futuristic, which is around AVs. So how will autonomous vehicles be deployed at scale, quote unquote, and under which use cases? And what I mean by use cases is, robo-taxis in San Francisco, shared autonomous shuttles like in Munich, Germany, or other types of implementations, let's say in Singapore, Seoul, and more of East Asia.
So this is a complicated answer.
You can cherry pick one and just go with it if you
Yeah,
want.
no. I mean, this is the issues of AVs are a complicated issue. If you had asked me this a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, it seemed like their momentum was picking up again. So there was a lot of momentum, I'd say, in the late 2010s, and then it waned a good amount with COVID and with all sorts of problems that the companies were having actually delivering self-driving cars. Started to pick up in the last couple of years, especially around San Francisco, with all the work that Cruise and Waymo were doing there, and then got a huge bucket of cold water with the issues that GM Cruise ran into in the area. A whole lot of like mishaps. They hit also more than a mishap, really, like a very severe crash where they hit a woman, a pedestrian. She was under the car, and then the car stopped and then moved again and dragged the woman 20 feet.
Yeah.
Huge kind of issues. So that I think that put a little bit of a damper on the speed at which I think a understandable, reasonable, and good damper on the speed at which these technologies we're deploying. We're seeing more, we'll say, growth in this sector right now, but it is very measured. It is slow. There's just a few cities that actually are a handful of cities that are actually providing these services. And it's still, I'd say, very much in they're starting to get larger pilots, but it's still in the pilot mode, right? We're not at full scale. There's a lot of questions around this. And one of them is, can the vehicles actually work technically at full scale? My sense is eventually we're going to get there. We're not quite there yet, but we could. But a bigger question, I think it goes to the question you asked of like these use cases. And I would say not only is it kind of this shared, I mean, so I would add three major different models, right? One of them is a kind of Uber-like a shared robotaxi type thing. Another one is an owned Tesla type thing. So I own my own AV and it does what I need for me. And then the third model is this kind of a shuttle, right? That comes by, has a whole bunch of people in it, picks me up and drops me off. And it's not clear to me right now how any of those, the business models for any of those. The Tesla one seems to make sense if you can make it work. It's not clear that that's actually possible to have AVs that work on the individual ownership level. The Teslas has run into a lot of problems with what they've done so far. As you know, they don't use LiDAR, they only use video, which creates problems, which creates fatalities. And so the question of is that a feasible system is still a question mark. The robotaxi model that Waymo and GM Cruise are doing it seems to be working better, especially the Waymo deployment of it seems to be working better technically. But there's a question of what the business model is. Right now they're operating in central cities where there's origins and destinations are close by. There's a high density of activity, high density of people. But will robo-taxis work as well if we think of them out in suburban areas or in rural areas? I'm not exactly sure. And they're not cheap. Uber has gotten more expensive as time has gone on, which has kind of shown that the rideshare model really works best in dense areas and only as an expensive thing. So there's a whole lot of questions of is does this have what's the long-term business model? Will it work for entire metropolitan areas, or also including ex-urban and rural areas? How much will this be able to really take over everything, or is it mainly a service that exists in central cities for wealthier people? And to me, that would be a big problem because central cities don't really need new transportation options. We already have a lot of transportation options there, and also wealthy people already have a lot of transportation options. So this is kind of a conundrum, which the benefits of AVs really start to come about when they're widespread, but if the business model doesn't lead to them being widespread, that's a problem. And then the shuttle version that exists of AVs right now is, I'd say, is the slowest of the three options. There hasn't been a whole lot of uptake of these things. The kind of shuttles that exist, they're typically low speed shuttles, and if they were really kind of replace transit trips or transit vehicles, that could be an option. But right now, there's a whole lot of challenges in that space. So I'd say the future of AVs is unclear exactly what it's going to be. And a big question for me is the use cases and the business model.
Yeah, more questions than answers. It's a muddled landscape. Back to the final use case around shared autonomous shuttles. I know, like I'd mentioned, Munich, Germany, MVG, their PTAs, public transit, authority is doing an interesting kind of trial of low speed shuttles, kind of like a micro transit DRT type, smartphone booking based, model. I believe it's more like a feeder service into their kind of higher frequency, fixed route bus and light rail lines. So it's an interesting, like maybe an add-on or complement. Does it need to be autonomous or could it be, human, driven as a DRT slash micro transit feeder service? So, it's just another, let's say, I would say, kind of experiment to see what the appetite is, but the business model again still isn't clear. And again, it is this can this be at scale? I don't know. So yeah, more, again,
And
more questions than answers, so.
one of the things you run into in any of the shared models, either in robotaxis or with these kind of shuttles, is do you need to have a person on board, right? So the driver
Right.
right now, on the one hand, like drives the vehicle, but they also do some wayfinding, help people out. If there's a problem on board, they help with that. If there's a someone's
Concierge,
behaving
but
badly, they can intervene.
sure.
How comfortable will we feel to be in a 20-person shuttle with myself and one other person, especially if I'm someone who I feel like I'm in a vulnerable population? That I'm not sure if how that will work. And I'd say like it, I'm not saying it won't work, but there's still a lot of questions.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Bay Area Rapid Transit in the San Francisco Bay Area, BART was supposed to be driverless back in 1972 in the Nixon, administration. Never happened. So, but the network was set up for that. That was their ambitions 50 plus years ago. So
And there are like subway type or heavy rail autonomous movement. So London has some of these, Santiago in Chile has some of these, and those seem to work better because they're large enough that you're rarely alone in them, right? But if you get into these smaller spaces, I think people might feel more uncomfortable. Yeah, so all remains to be seen. Remains to be seen.
Okay, let's jump right into your book here, Sustainable Urban Design Framework. So tell us about it. I know it just was published and launched recently. I think you went on a book tour. You've been kind of sharing a lot of your insights and inspirations. So we'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so the book's called The Sustainable Urban Design Handbook, and it
Yeah,
is
sorry.
based on the Sustainable Urban Design Framework that you
Okay.
mentioned. And what it basically does is it tries to simplify what is typically thought of as a tremendously complicated issue, which is how do you create sustainability in the built environment, which varies a ton depending on what kind of context you're in, right? climate, politics, culture, economics, a whole bunch of kind of differences. And it takes this fairly complicated topic and breaks it down into understandable chunks. So the framework that it's based on has on one side of it is talks about these outcome goals. So energy use based on and greenhouse gas based on transportation and land use, water, how do we limit the amount of stormwater and runoff that we have? How do we like help natural water cycles? Ecology and habitat, how do we help, create species robustness in urban areas? Energy use and productions on non-transportation issues. These are things like urban heat island effect and embodied energy. And then equity and health, how do we deal with things like affordability, accessibility, safety, physical activity, and social mobility? So it has these outcome goals, and then it kind of organizes them across these different scales that we work on in urban design. So region and city, district and neighborhood, and then block and street and project and parcel. Block and street and project and parcel are similar scales, but mostly public realm and private realm. And what the framework does then within that framework, so you can think of this as a matrix, we think we put specific urban design elements, physical things that you can do in the city, organized within that matrix. And hopefully, Scott, you can add a link to the framework in the announcements about this. But what that framework does is it has all these specific urban design elements organized along these realms. So you can look and say, well, I've got a project at the block and street scale, and it kind of lets you look at all the things that you need to be thinking about at that scale, all the questions you need to be asking. Or you ask yourself, I'd really like to do a project that helps. I'm really interested in having, stormwater be dealt with. Well, here's all the things you need to do at all these different scales to make that work. So you can use this as a design guide to help you in a design process. You can use it as a as an evaluation tool. How sustainable is this place? Looking at different schemes, for instance, how would it improve all these different dimensions? You can use it as a stakeholder engagement tool. So stakeholders typically, I'd say clients and stakeholders, community stakeholders typically understand what outcomes they want, but they don't necessarily understand the physical things that need to happen in the built environment at these different scales to make that work. And so this kind of helps lay that out. I often call this a magic decoder ring that helps translate those things. So the hope is that it takes what is a fairly complicated topic, simplifies it so that people can actually act upon it. And I'll just add that what the book does is it takes the framework and each element in the framework, there's 50 some odd elements in the framework, has its own chapter. And each chapter describes the element, describes how it relates to other elements, metrics around it, what's a recommended approach, typical approaches, why it's important, considerations and caveats, and then it gives you design guides, like basic things you can be doing to help take steps forward in that element.
Yeah, we'll definitely add a link to the framework and the book and everything else related to that kind of in a social media when we publish the podcast episode for sure. And it sounds to me, I mean, I could be wrong. I need to probably delve into the handbook a bit more, but it's building upon the work, in terms of traditional neighborhood development, some of the work of the maybe some of the work of the Congress of New Urbanism, the Transect, maybe perhaps looking at some of the work from OptiCoast Design in Berkeley around the missing middle, but taking a much more macro view, a comprehensive view of how all these different concepts can be stitched together here, now, writ large in 2024, and what matters for public policy as well as stakeholders that want to put this into practice. But it seems like a lot of these concepts are really synthesized in a much more approachable format that some of these past publications that were maybe a bit more of an echo chamber, shall we say.
Yeah, so we definitely build on a lot of fantastic research that exists out there, and to me, the biggest success in what we've done is really synthesizing a whole lot of information and
Yeah,
simplifying it,
sounds like
getting
a
down to the
synthesis.
core of what you need to do. And there's definitely people from the movements you talked about that have we've included in this work, but also people outside of those movements. So I think that we definitely support and are continuing to push in that direction, but I wouldn't say it's limited to that. The other thing that we really look at is, moving well beyond the, we'll say the human aspects of this. So thinking beyond, kind of transportation, land use, and energy use, and really think a lot about kind of stormwater issues, ecology, and then a big push also on the equity side. which we're really excited about within this.
Yeah, and of course that's been lacking in the whole dialogue up until the last few years and a lot of these different kind of new urban publications and everything. And it's great to hear that you're a bit more agnostic, where you're kind of drawing upon multiple, let's say, strands and movements towards a more comprehensive synthesis, as you mentioned. So I think that's very encouraging. It's let's put it this way, it's a little bit less dogmatic. It's that's the way to go. That's the way to go if
And
we're going to.
to be clear, there's a lot of fantastic things coming from the movements that you talked about.
Yeah, of
Absolutely.
course. And I'm a
Just trying
proponent
to.
too, but there's a slippery slope though. You want to maintain a balance and not alienate certain stakeholders to make sure that more people lean in, of course. That's more what I'm kind of getting at. Okay, I think we have probably time for one more question here. So, what are some of the key future-proofing techniques cities can leverage for new mobility? So we're hitting upon the Sustainable Urban Design Handbook, hitting upon some of the use cases around autonomous vehicles and mobility innovations. And how can cities really use their
What should they
regulatory,
do?
from a policy and regulatory standpoint, but to also encourage innovation at the same time?
Great. All right. So I'm going to say two things. One of them is that with all the work that we do in emerging technology and looking at these new models and understanding what use cases really might work or might not work, and also some of the friction that exists and actually the implementation of a lot of these things, the thing I say a lot of the time is the old rules are still the new rules. So do not expect self-driving cars to save us on the, energy front, or to save us on the sustainability front, or save us in the livability front. I would say don't expect any technology to save us from these things. We can leverage them to help with these things, but they are not the answer. Technology is not going to be the thing that gets us there. The old rules are still the new rules. We still need to have dense, multimodal, mixed use, compact development, communities. So the things that we keep on pushing for or push for, historically, for people in urbanism, are continue to be those things. And I would say, of all the things that if you want to do one thing to really, if you could only do one thing to help make places more sustainable, it would be increased density. That one, increased density doesn't guarantee that you're going to be more sustainable in a bunch of different ways, but it does make it possible. A lack of density really creates all sorts of problems for transportation, for equity, for stormwater issues, for ecological issues. It just creates problems everywhere. So, if there was a policy that I would tell people to focus on, if they really were interested in sustainability and livability and equity in their cities, it would be allowing more density and fomenting more density, even like inspiring more density. Would be like absolutely the number one thing. That's not enough, right? So we need to make sure that this density is livable and has a good quality of life around it. So thinking about, I'm not talking about massive density where, skyscrapers everywhere and, dark canyons. But a density that's strong, high enough to support transit. I think a lot of the densities we see in a lot of Dutch cities are fantastic. It's tremendously livable, and yet it's dense enough that it allows all these different things to happen in terms of stormwater, in terms of mobility. On the other side of it, with thinking about more the innovation side, I think one of the things that is really important is to maybe this is the thing not to be dogmatic in, is to pilot, to test things, test things, test things. There's a lot of fantastic opportunities with some of these technologies. I'll say mobility as a service, even though it's has slightly gone out of favor. There's a lot of transit agencies that are continuing to develop it, and with great success and interest. Berlin is a really good example. Some of the things happening in TransLink in Vancouver is a really good example. So I think there's big opportunities with this, but a lot of these things are still untested in terms of what the frictions are of implementation, and untested in terms of really understanding how the benefits will work out. So, the big piece is be willing to experiment, test, and then also revisit. So I would say don't create any policies on emerging technology, new mobility, e-commerce that is permanent. Create policies that you will revisit, every year, to and set the expectation that you're going to be revisiting them so that you can tweak them and align them better with to get to the outcome goals that you want.
You covered a lot of great stuff here. The first point, I'm going to probably truncate our last question so we can just have a conversation, then we'll just leave with some final
Sure.
thoughts for you. But your first point about density, yeah, I think, and middle density really, that's where kind
Yes.
of the
Yes.
missing goal comes in, you know, with Dan Perelek, what they're doing in Berkeley, but also, you know, like Dutch slash European urbanism, 4 or 5 story buildings, smaller, tighter street networks, really much closer activities that promote walkability and human centric activity that, you know, kind of activate our built environment. I mean, that versus these, enormous, dense, urban canyons of extremely high density of the mega cities or super low density horizontal cities. So there is really kind of that Goldilocks zone, that sweet spot of density.
Yeah.
4 or 5 story buildings. I don't know how many people per dwelling unit. I forget the formula. I'm sure you know. You could probably tell the audience here. But yeah, it's really it kind of attracts people to their surroundings. Kind of that almost that figure ground relationship. You know, in terms of our neighborhoods. So I mean that's a great point you make, and I think there's tons of opportunities throughout, especially North America. I think a little better off here in Europe, I must say, but in North America, tons of opportunities to increase densities to that middle tier throughout the US. You know, start building on surface parking lots. You know, if you look at all these maps of Kansas City, Phoenix, St. Louis, I mean, tons of opportunities throughout the US to really infill and, you know, really start focusing on these types of developments. And then to pivot on another topic you mentioned in terms of, you know, trying to be agile and encouraging pilots. I totally agree with you on that. I think, governments and cities definitely have to be very open for kind of innovation and technology. Albeit, though, there's a little bit of a slippery slope, though, where pilots can go a little too far, or as they say, jumping the shark, where pilots go too long last, like what we're seeing in UK right now with micromobility e-scooters. There's no terminal end to these pilots. They've been going on for like 4 or 5 years, and it gets to a point where it's a pilot fatigue. So I think, you know, while I agree with you, and not certainly not to challenge, I think we should all be in the spirit of encouraging innovation pilots, but there still has to be kind of a path to operationalization, procurement, and kind of embedding in our framework so that let's say new vendors and new technology providers have a clear path to let's say selling to government, whether it's software or hardware. So yeah, it's
So I agree with you that like and to be clear, like what I was saying before, piloting is not just simply like doing a bunch of little tests. The
yeah.
pilots should then like slowly scale to get to larger scale deployment. But even when you're at larger scale deployment, you should be revisiting how it is that the rules of the game that you've set up are actually playing out, because nobody knows how these technologies really play out at larger scales, right? So I think we're getting closer with scooters and with e-bikes and shared bikes, but we're still not exactly sure what the overall impacts are. And so just making sure that we don't lock ourselves as governments, you don't lock yourself into a certain thing that then might not have the impacts and the outcomes that you want.
And then we take the two extreme example where just these modalities are completely banned, whether it's in Melbourne, Paris, Madrid, et cetera, that's the other end of the extreme as well too. And then the final point on MaaS, my world has been in mobility as a service for quite a many years though, and the lack of profitability in MaaS and how there's really no commercial model, at least business to consumer, and how the government is taking a much more active role to let's say promoting, stimulating and subsidizing MaaS. So going out to public tenders and RFPs, certainly in the Netherlands, Spain, many markets, very interesting trial work with TransLink you mentioned in Vancouver, British Columbia. But again, the government's taking much more of an active role leaning in on promoting MaaS as a digital infrastructure layer to basically encourage modal shift and promote public transport, public transit. And I would say mobility as a service certainly has a bright future, but with a larger elements in terms of kind of a subsidized role, just like what public transit is anyway. So that's the only way it
Absolutely.
can exist.
Yeah, that you hit it exactly on the head. So
It's been my world, so.
Yeah, so I in addition to the work I do at University of Oregon and Urbanism Next Center, I'm also a strategic advisor and researcher at TNO, which is a Dutch national think tank. And we just put together a report called Public Mobility, the Next Iteration of Maas. And in that, we talk about this shift from what I call Maas 1.0 to Maas 2.0, where Maas 1.0 was the idea was that it's profitable, right? And all you need is an app,
Hopefully be profitable, which it
right?
was.
Which both of those things are not true, right? So Maas 2.0 has realized one, it's not prop. One, it's not an app, right? Like an app is part of it, but you need an entire ecosystem to actually make Maas work, and you have to develop that entire ecosystem. And two, it's not profitable. So if you think that the private sector is going to develop it on its own and make money off of that, it's not going to happen. But that doesn't mean it shouldn't happen. It just means that you have to think about, as you mentioned, public transit is subsidized. Well, partly because it's good for society overall, and I'll say it's
It's a
good for,
public good. It's a public
it's
good.
a public good. It's also an
That's it.
economic good, right? It helps the entire society. And so I think what governments are looking at right now and transit agencies are looking at is, are there opportunities for Maas? Are there ways that Maas can help us get to the goals that we want? And if
Exactly.
so, that might be cheaper than adding another lane of travel or, to a road or something. And so to me, there's lots of opportunities in that. And we're just now in the midst of this shift to Maas 2.0, and really as you mentioned, transit agencies and cities are leading the way of, oh, this might actually have some benefit for us.
Yeah, and we're just skimming the surface. It's just the start. So it gives me a lot of encouragement for the future. So we only have 2 more minutes left. So I'm going to hand you the mic. Maybe just you can tell the audience where we can find you on social media, some of your next speaking engagements, and then we'll just close out.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me here. Really appreciate it. You can find more of the book on the link that hopefully Scott's going to be putting on this. It's available in the large booksellers, the Sustainable Urban Design Handbook. And if you look up Sustainable Urban Design and Nico Larko, you should find a blog page that has a lot of information about the book. In terms of next steps, there's we're going to be on the APA podcast shortly, and a couple other podcasts we're doing for this. And if anyone else is interested in talking about how we create more sustainable urban environments, I'd love to be talking to them as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nico. So really excited to have you. Hope to have you on for a part two in the future. I'm sure we'll probably join forces at some point at Urbanism next year, maybe in Rotterdam or whatnot, when you're back here in Europe. But it's been a real pleasure to kind of chat with you. Hopefully we'll have you on for a longer episode, maybe with some others, to really delve deep into urbanism and mobility and kind of these intersecting themes. So thanks so much for joining and kind of being our guest.
Great. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks.